Welcome back, party people. Thank you for joining us.
Is that what you say for party people?
That was her sound effects. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Live Like an Athlete. I'm Erin Schroney. I'm joined, as you just heard, by Big Herc.
Yeah.
Big Herc is back in the building after he abandoned us for last week's podcast.
I know, but you didn't, you know, take me off the email chain, and I appreciate that because this morning I got an email from the lovely Miss Schroney that said, "The best video you'll see all day." Now, this is a great teaser, so of course I clicked it open and watched the video, and it was a video of a cab driver, a comedian, I guess, who put a python in a cab with them, and he got the people in the cab, and then it kept creeping out, and these people would freak out or whatever like that. So I write back to Erin, I said, "You know me too well." I said, "This is something I would totally do to people."
And absolutely.
I was cracking up.
Absolutely. Even though this has absolutely nothing to do with living like an athlete. Although I'm sure some athlete somewhere probably has a python. But yes, it was a very funny video. You guys should check it out. It has nothing to do with our podcast. But I think it was the New York Post or somebody posted it. And I'm a New Yorker, so I appreciated it. Because the entire thing was just people getting into this cab. And this giant python snake would like poke its head out. And it would just be a string of curse words. So the entire video is just like... bleep, 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 bleep.
And it's so great because no one was like, you know, they were all screaming at the cabbie. They didn't care if the snake got away. They just couldn't believe what he did.
That's right. I'm not sure if python is on the endangered list. It probably is, and therefore you can't eat it. So it wouldn't fit in with the theme of our discussion this week. Our topic this week. Actually, Herc, this is perfect because our topic this week has to do with eating like an athlete, and March is National Nutrition Month. I bet you didn't know that.
Nice. Now, you weren't really happy with, I went to a baseball game last week, and I had a taco and a helmet, and you were saying that's not very healthy, but let me tell you something. If you're ever in Port St. Lucie for a New York Mets spring training game, all right, $6, you get nachos, you get meat, you get lettuce, with all the food groups in there, you get jalapeno, salsa. Yeah. Best deal you're going to find in the Grapefruit League.
Do you know in the Grapefruit League?
Listen, Herc. We're going to have Ken Berger on soon. We can ask him what's the best meal in the whole entire NBA. But
that's right. Well, I'll get to our guests.
All right.
Spoiler alert.
Yes.
But yeah, they can tell you more about why your meal in a helmet is probably not very good for you.
But good deal though.
BPA and the plastic helmet aside, in the burning hot heat. But whatever, that's the subject of another podcast entirely. Anyway, thanks for coming back, dear listeners. If you were with us last week, then you heard us talk to elite ultra marathon runner Samantha Gash. She's a chick who ran 620 miles across 4 deserts. Herc missed that because he left us, as he just said, to go eat a taco out of a helmet in Port St. Lucie.
No, that was another day.
But
and the other day, I can't remember what I did.
Oh.
Sorry. Just kidding.
Well, you're confusing your taco helmet days. Anyway, if you missed that one, head on over to iTunes. Please subscribe to the podcast. This is my weekly call for you to subscribe to the podcast. Check it out. And Herc,
yes.
Speaking of extreme, this is a good time for our usual CYA disclaimer, which you know I have to read
yes.
in my news anchor voice.
Maybe let me do it one day, and I can try out my anchor voice.
Okay, next week.
All right, we got it. Deal.
All right. I want to remind everybody listening that in no way, shape, or form should this be considered as medical advice, a substitute for a professional opinion, etc. This is for your personal entertainment and edification only. Please advise a physician before beginning any exercise program or making changes to your diet. Moving on. You brought up the Grapefruit League. You brought up Port St. Lucie. Every week I try and relate this all back to some sort of current event in sports. Yeah. And so we can focus on MLB spring training, right?
Sure.
I figured we're going to talk about nutrition. We're going to talk about eating like an athlete and recreating your body and reprogramming your genes, which is the topic. Why not talk about spring training and those guys who are obviously undergoing all sorts of evaluation, tracking their progress, seeing where they need to be at, working on getting there, improving. That's their time for sort of recreating their bodies, getting ready for the season, right? And nutrition is a huge aspect. There's obviously many components, but nutrition's a large percent of it, whether you like it or not.
Absolutely.
You need the energy to perform. So with that said, we got a very special guest today. I'm going to waste no time in bringing them on because they're waiting patiently on the line, who you'll love. But I also have another little treat. We invited our CBS Sports NBA insider, Ken Berger, on with us.
Yeah.
Hooray! And why?
Good to be here, guys.
Hi, Ken.
I hope I don't spoil the fun. You guys are having too much fun already.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's, you know, that's why I asked Herc to be part of this thing, because otherwise it would just be dry and boring with me.
I'm a wild card. Sometimes she has to rein me back in, but I just like to run wild. So
you should see Herc, because he's literally running wild in the studio right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
Flexing his biceps. Ken. For anyone out there who's listening and doesn't know, Ken is an awesome human being, number one, which is why he's involved. But number two, he's also a nutrition nerd and a fitness freak like me. And he wrote the most amazing 3-part series on nutrition in the NBA, which actually featured our special guest today. So, of course, we had to have him in the mix. And getting to that, our special guest, she is Dr. Kate Shanahan. She is the physician responsible for the LA Lakers food supply and team nutrition overhaul. But don't blame her for their current woes. She fixed Dwight Howard's scary blood sugar issues, among plenty of other things. Ken interviewed her about this, and you can read up on that in his article on CBSSports.com, Nutrition in the NBA. Just search for it. It's really, really good. So I thought, let's get Dr. Shanahan on. Let's delve deeper into this conversation and have her explain the principles behind her philosophy in her book, Deep Nutrition, how nutrition affects our gene expression, and most importantly, how you guys listening can apply it as non-athletes, or maybe you're an athlete, in which case you benefit twice.
I'm going to ask her if taco and helmet constitutes deep nutrition.
Okay, Herc. So with that, we welcome Dr. Kate Shanahan.
Thank you, Aaron, for bringing me into the mix here in this brand new podcast.
Absolutely. We're so excited to have you. I will make a disclaimer and say that I have been stalking poor Dr. Shanahan ever since Ken and I did the NBA nutrition video, asking her all sorts of personal advice, and she's literally...
And she comes on the show with a restraining order. Wow, she's really nice.
She's a wonderful woman.
Aaron makes me think.
Just a quick bit of background on Dr. Shanahan. She's a practicing family physician and the author of 2 amazing books, Deep Nutrition and Food Rules. They're both available on Amazon. She's trained in biochemistry and genetics with a degree from Cornell University. She practiced medicine in Kauai, Hawaii, of which I am supremely jealous, for 10 years, where she studied ethnobotany and her healthiest patients' culinary habits. This led her to make the connection between a traditional, ancestral, primal way of eating and healthy gene expression. So, Kate, I guess we'll start with you. And Ken, since you've already interviewed Kate, of course, please feel free to jump in as we go on.
Sure.
But Kate, why don't we start, just tell us some quick background on your work with the Lakers and guys like Dwight Howard, for those who haven't yet read Ken's article, and how it relates to your approach to this deep nutrition.
Well, my whole approach around medicine is to get a person eating the foods that their genes expect them to eat. Because the underlying philosophy that I have is when you do that, that then you become healthy. And I guess better stated that the underlying philosophy is that our genes do have certain expectations. And whether we are healthy or sick is a reflection of how well we are meeting those expectations, and not just a reflection of randomness or chance. Which in our current society, the way of expressing chance is, oh, just bad genes or bad family history. It's all, there's a design underlying all this. There's an order, there's an expectation. And what we need to do is figure out what that is so that we can meet it. And then we get everybody healthy inevitably. Health is an inevitable outcome of making our genes happy.
Can you give us just a quick rundown on how we, regular people, how we meet those, you know, expectations and what food we need to target?
Yeah, so focusing on specifically on nutrition, because obviously there's other elements, right? You need relaxation, sleep, exercise, and all that. But the nutrition element of it is to, very simply put, to do what our ancestors have done. And we don't have to go all the way back to the Paleolithic era, but starting there, we know that our ancestors ate a lot of meat and probably foraged for whatever sort of vegetable matter they could get their hands on. And then upgrading that with the more recent culinary traditions, you know, the invention of cooking and fire and cooking tools. Luke is my co-author and husband. When we wrote the
book, awesome.
Yes, he is very awesome. We just had our anniversary yesterday, so
congratulations.
He has been awesome now for 19 years and a day. The centerpiece of our book, it defines exactly what those culinary traditions are, what our genes expect. We call them the four pillars of world cuisine because there's four components of culinary activity. So would you like me to review those now, or do you want to
Yeah, we can jump right into it because I'm sure everyone who's listening.
All right. So the first one is to eat fresh food. That's like the most obvious, immediate thing. That's what all animals do. And by fresh food, I mean stuff that hasn't been cooked. So we're talking about not just plants, but also animal products, because all traditional cuisines do have components or have meals that are not cooked, like sushi and ceviche and stuff people do with eggs, like eggnog. So that's fresh. The first pillar. And then if you have too much fresh stuff around because you're such a good hunter or gatherer, you got to preserve it. How do you do that without refrigeration or canning? Fermentation, that's your biggest ally. So that's pillar number two, is fermented and sprouted. Sprouting seeds also makes them more digestible. So for those not familiar with what fermentation means, it means allowing good bacteria to invest in the food product in a way that preserves it from bad molds and stuff that makes it just plain gross. And admittedly, there is a fine line between just plain gross and some fermented foods. Like if anyone has ever had yogurt, you know, for the first time, that can be a little sour, a little shocking, takes some getting used to. But generally, yogurt eventually goes down well, especially with fruit. But other foods like natto, that's a fermented soy, is very ammonia flavored and quite an acquired taste. So there's all kinds of fermented foods out there. Pretty much anything that you can eat fresh can also be eaten in a fermented or after having been fermented. And that enhances the nutrition because good bacteria produce vitamins, and good bacteria also serve us when we eat them. They flourish in our intestinal tract and protect us from bad bacteria.
So Kate, one example, just for anyone who's maybe not quite sure what's accessible to them on the fermented food front and they're not interested in drinking kombucha, like sauerkraut, right? If you can get organic sauerkraut, that's a fermented food.
Yeah, perfect example. So if you have sauerkraut, if you have a health food store, pretty much any health food store is going to have some sauerkraut in the chill section. So the sauerkraut that you get that's just in one of those plastic sacks or, you know, not in a chill section, or that's just pickled in vinegar, has not been fermented. It won't have the good bacteria. It's not bad for you. It's just going to not be have that extra element of nutrition. Often it's called like real sauerkraut or fermented sauerkraut. Same with pickles, kimchi. Those are some real accessible vegetable, fermented vegetable dishes or side dishes. And there's no reason you can't have like fermented sauerkraut on, say, like a grass-fed beef hot dog. And that's a super healthy, deep nutrition kind of a snack or meal.
See, I'm already digging this because, you know, she says, you know, hunting or whatever like that. See, I'm like the Tyrannosaurus Rex. Big Herc wants to hunt. He doesn't want to be fed. So
I like that you refer to yourself in the third person as well.
But Ken knows we're writers. You know, they tell us in J school we all have ego. So, you know.
There you go. Yeah, yes. Right. You have not transcended the ego yet.
Exactly.
The Buddhism eludes you. Kate, what's the third pillar so that Herc can get on hunting?
Okay, so we've got fresh, fermented, and sprouted. And then the third is meat on the bone. So this gets to the idea that if you've gone through the trouble of hunting down an animal, done all that exercise, you're going to eat as much of it as you can. And so that includes figuring out a way to get the connective tissues in there, the bone, the joint material, even the skin. And when you do that, usually people have to boil it, right? You can eat skin without making it into soup, but you have to boil the bones and the joint material in water for an extended period of time, hours or even days. And you extract this family of molecules called glycosaminoglycans, which are like the missing food group from the American culinary landscape. We really need those glycosaminoglycans in order for our connective tissues to be as healthy as they can be. And when we don't get that, it contributes to accelerated aging because our connective tissue, our collagen, is what keeps us young for as long as possible. So soup stocks and sauces made from boiling bones are part of all traditional cuisines around the world.
Chicken
and
soup,
we
Jewish
need to bring them back to America.
Right?
Delicious.
And the fourth pillar, Kate?
So the fourth pillar is also along those lines. It's organ meats. And the reason we isolate organ meats out, you know, you could say, okay, well, it's sort of part of the whole animal concept. The reason I need to isolate organ meats out is because each organ in an animal's body, the liver, the heart, the kidneys, is like a deposit, a depository of nutrients that you really don't get in anywhere near the same concentration in the muscle tissue that we commonly eat. And so unless your diet includes organ meats, you're going to be deficient in some category of vitamins and really need to take supplements. So these things are like the original supplements. You know, when people used to include organ meats in their diet on a regular basis, we had such an intense amount of nutrition compared to what we get these days without supplementation.
Hmm. Yeah. And all those things make sense. Do they make sense to you, Herc?
Oh, absolutely.
Running after your wild deer in the Fort Lauderdale forest up here?
Absolutely. And especially the part she's talking about, you know, I take a multivitamin and she's absolutely right. You know, people don't get all the nutrients they need from what they eat during the day. So a nice multivitamin in the morning helps you get through the day and helps you supplement your meals.
Right. Though I think that Kate would tell us all to get it from food, ideally, if we could, and not from the grapefruit taco bowl, which we'll talk about later. But I want to bring Ken into the mix because he's on the call too. And Ken, much like me, you sort of are this like nutrition nerd and whatever, however you want to phrase it. You're a CrossFit enthusiast, something I don't do, but that you're actually certified in. And so you interviewed Kate before I even met her. That's how I met her. And I don't know. I mean, after speaking to Kate about her approach, I know that I adopted and applied a lot of her principles. Did you have that same experience, or was there anything you learned in the process of writing that NBA nutrition article that kind of opened your eyes that you were able to apply to your own life?
I did, absolutely. And it was really interesting talking to Dr. Kate about what she was doing with the Lakers. And I was fascinated by the approach. I already knew a little bit about nutrition and how athletes should be eating through my own experience. I had started, I guess this was in the summer of 2009. I told Kate a little bit about my story and my background, but you know, I had been a sports writer for quite a few years, been on, you know, on the road, traveling, eating out in restaurants, not necessarily paying attention to the quality of the food that I was eating. And you know, I woke up one day in Las Vegas at Summer League after my first full season of covering the NBA for CBSSports.com. And I realized how far off track I had gotten. I was always an athlete. I was a competitive athlete in high school. I had lifted weights for years. I was always very health conscious. And the lifestyle of being on the road and working late nights and not getting a lot of sleep, you know, I was probably 25 to 30 pounds overweight, just felt awful. And my brother introduced me to CrossFit. I started trying to do some of the exercises as best I could, and it was a real struggle. And through CrossFit, I became aware of the paleo diet and became aware of Rob Wolf, read his incredible book about that. And so I proceeded to lose about 28 pounds over the course of a year, following a fairly strict paleo diet. And you know, that means basically you're eating, you know, lean meats, fish, nuts, seeds, fruits, and vegetables, and you're not eating any processed food. You're not eating any grains. You're cutting all the gluten out. You're not eating any dairy even. But I found that as I progressed through this and I became, you know, I went from barely being able to do a pull-up to being, you know, participating in CrossFit competitions, I felt like I was missing something. I was running out of gas in my workouts. I was not feeling as much energy as I thought I should. So I kind of you know, through interviewing Kate for the story, I started adopting some of her principles as well. And I really feel like those are the missing, those are the pieces that I'm missing. I have to admit, I haven't gone full bore with the organ meats just yet.
Nor have I.
That's the advanced level.
Right.
Ken and I are just intermediates.
Right. And they're tricky to cook too. So, you know, you have to know how to prepare that stuff and you have to kind of learn how to cook that stuff and you have to have the time to. But I
and
guess my question
buds.
Right. You have to it's like anything else. It's an acquired taste. But I guess my question for Kate would be, and I experienced some of this in interviewing players in the NBA about diet, players on the Lakers about her approach. Some of them really embraced it 100%. Others were a little bit on the fence. Others were a little bit afraid of it. You know, the notion that, you know, if you're a professional or any type of high level athlete, that you can out train a bad diet. I would just be curious to get Kate's thoughts on that, because a lot of the players that I deal with who are in their 20s, they've been eating McDonald's their whole life and they're in the NBA making millions of dollars. So why should they do anything different? And there's a notion even among, you know, my casual friends and people in my everyday life, you know, they say, well, you're in such great shape because you work out like a maniac. But I think they're missing the point. And I wonder what Kate thinks about people who think as long as you just exercise like crazy, you can eat whatever you want.
Ken, it's like Chad Johnson, you know, our buddy Ocho Cinco during fantasy season, who's in the studio, who brings McDonald's and then insists he eats it four times a day and he still performs at a high level. I mean, I just think he's a genetic freak of nature and it will catch up to him, which is what I tell him and he doesn't want to hear. But Kate, what do you think?
Well, you put it perfectly, Aaron. He is a genetic freak, and it will catch up to him.
Oh.
So what I mean by genetic freak is that it ties back to what I started with the introduction, where I talk about giving your genes what they expect. Because the longer that your genes have to do without what they expect, the more you're going to see problems. And it's not just your lifetime. It actually goes back with, you know, the entire memory of your genetic history, which goes back generations. So it depends on what your parents and grandparents did. So, this person you were just referring to, no doubt his parents and grandparents were following much more closely the deep nutrition four pillars, kind of a way of eating. And he benefited hugely from that. But what I don't want to see is losing that, I call it genetic momentum or genetic wealth in the book. So genetic wealth just refers to how much power basically you have in your genetic bank to withstand the onslaught of, you know, either starvation or toxins in, you know, French fries and other foods that you'll get on the road, fast foods, stuff like that. And the more genetic wealth you have, the more momentum that you have in the direction of being able to withstand all kinds of junk food and not just junk food, but other lifestyle, you know, slippages where you don't do the right kind of exercises and you don't get enough sleep and maybe you smoke and all that kind of stuff. So your genes are constantly performing this complex series of equations for you to figure out, you know, how much you can handle, before you get sick. And I don't want to see anybody have to find out the hard way, you know, that, oops, that was too much, right? Because you never really know. And I think what we're seeing with a lot of the players in the NBA who've become injured and who have had difficulty recovering is that they pushed it a little bit too far before they got to the point where they figured out, gosh, I really need to take my diet seriously. Or, and this happens all too often, they thought they were taking their diet seriously, but they weren't getting the right information, and so that there were major deficiencies. And so you see, I think one of the biggest things that we're seeing now that strikes me anyway is these unusual bone fractures, like with low impact injury, where you know, people have a minor impact, like Steve Nash and those.
Kobe has one too.
Himself, yeah. Yes. With where your bone health depends on, of course, what your genetics predispose you to, but also so many decades of what you've done. And I know that milk is not a big thing in the NBA. You know, the preferred fluid is much more fluorescent than milk. And
because
it's,
the preferred fluid pays for things, but yeah, that's another podcast.
True.
And it displaces, right? It, you know, athletes do need a lot of calories, and so they can get away with eating that sort of fluorescent food without gaining weight, but the nutrition isn't there, and so something is having to do without. Some part of their body is struggling to make do with not enough. And very often, the place that we find has struggled the most is the bones. And when we see this sometimes, you know, even earlier than the 30s, there was a young basketball player last year who had a fairly low impact fracture, and he basically severed his leg in half. I can't remember his name, but I think he was a college player at the time, and that was the end of his career. Can you guys remember his name?
Kevin Ware. I think you're talking about the Louisville.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he had two bones in his lower leg fractured, and they were such a complete fracture that really all that was holding him together, it was his skin. Yeah. You know, the muscles were severed. It was really horrific.
It was a gross gif to look back at.
Yeah, so we can shift our minds away from that image. But you know, that didn't happen 20, 30 years ago. We didn't have these low impact injuries causing fractures. And that we're seeing that now, what we're seeing on TV when we see that is a reflection of the fact that, you know, for several generations now, our genes have been making do with less. And particularly in this last generation, these last 20 years, kids are growing up on juice instead of milk. And so where are they getting the bone building calcium and other minerals from?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Kate, this must, I'm looking at a story on my screen right now that a friend of mine sent me, probably to be a wise ass, because he knows what I'm into, but he sent it to me. This must drive you crazy. This is in USA Today. Man loses 56 pounds after eating only McDonald's for 6 months.
The man also must have lost his erection, because as we all know from that movie, when you eat only McDonald's for a long period of time, you lose your erection. Men, FYI, go watch it if you don't believe me.
I'll tell you what, though, this is funny because you brought up Chad Johnson and Ken brought up McDonald's. My brother, I mean, he eats whatever he wants and he can't gain a damn pound. I keep telling my dad, I said, if we tap his metabolism and put in a pill, we'd be rich. I mean, he's like 130 pounds soaking wet.
Right, but we don't know what's going on the inside.
He sleeps a lot.
Right, under the surface there, we don't know. So I mean, any diet can be an example of a weight loss diet. But I totally agree with you. It is a frustrating thing where, you know, you just take a look at the surface and say, oh well, they look healthy or they've lost weight, they must be doing something right. Well, yes, they may be, but really, there are rules, and we need to pay attention to the rules. And those four pillars make up a great bulk of the rules. And as long as we're paying attention to those four pillars and getting that in our diet, then we really know we can be more confident that what's going on underneath the surface where we can't see it is the right stuff.
Sure. And Kate, you know, you mentioned when you were talking about the young athletes and them not really knowing or being misguided, there's a lot of common misconceptions when you talk about paleo / primal / ancestral, and you know, people are confused, and they have a right to be confused because there's a ton of conflicting info out there, including articles like the one Ken just mentioned, which is ridiculous. And then there's stuff, for instance, like a great article that Big Herc sent me yesterday from the Wall Street Journal, and I sent it to you as well. And it was titled "The Risk of High Protein Diets." And again, this is actually a misconception that I was even guilty of assuming, being a very knowledgeable person in the nutrition space, when I tried to adopt the quote paleo diet to begin with, because there's these different sort of variations. And what I like about yours, with its focus on good fats, is that it's not a high protein diet, because high protein diets make your pH very acidic, which is not healthy, and all sorts of, you know, there's a whole chain of bad reactions, which I'm sure you can comment better on, but you know, too much methionine and homocysteine. And so anyway, if you could clarify.
Stop trying to impress Dr. Kate, Aaron.
I am very impressed with Aaron.
All these big words.
I know. And I didn't even pay for medical school. It's amazing. I just looked at Google. No, but really this whole concept of, you know, having to load yourself with protein, it is dangerous to overdo anything, whether it's carbohydrates or protein or fat. You have to have the proper macronutrient ratio. And so I think, Kate, the question really is for people wanting to know, what is the proper macronutrient ratio generally, because it's going to be different for a pregnant woman versus a 20-year-old athlete. But generally, we're all human beings with the same DNA, more or less. And so we need certain things. And so if you could clarify, you know, what the benefits of a primal diet are versus this sort of misappropriation of the paleo method that's getting people into trouble and that's causing folks like the Wall Street Journal to write these kinds of articles.
Yeah, so we love talking about our food in terms of numbers and in terms of, like, you know, we love using those big, you know, macronutrients and percentages and stuff like this. And we need to do that, but it shouldn't be the starting point. And I feel like, we talk about this in our book, Deep Nutrition, as well, that where we got derailed was when we started analyzing the microcomponents of our food that we just happened to be random microcomponents that we discovered and defining them in those terms. So really the first thing is that we need to consider is, where did our food come from and what happened to it? And that gets us away from a lot of confusion about, well, this study showed that broccoli causes cancer and this study showed that meat causes cancer. And, you know, that's a micro picture. The macronutrient discussion is very, very important. And I'll answer the question, but it's a bigger, the bigger question is really the source and the tradition. So, you know, are we talking about animals that have been well fed? Are we talking about using the whole animal? And when you do that, you naturally get the right macronutrient ratios. That's how our ancestors did it. And those macronutrient ratios, as far as we can tell, seem to include at least 50% of the calories from fat, and sometimes more, depending on the time of year and depending on the geographic location, sometimes as much as up to even 85% of the calories from fat. Now, fat is very calorie dense, so we're not talking about like a plate full of fat. When we talk about half, 50% of the calories coming from fat, that's, you know, say you have a 200 calorie potato and then you have maybe 2 tablespoons of butter on it. That's 50-50 from, you know, carbs and fat right there. So it doesn't take very much, like, you know, quantity of fat to get 50% of your calories from fat. So it adds up quickly. And so with that range of maybe a low of somewhere around 50% of the calories from fat and then a high of 85% is important. It's not that there's a one number in there. We really do need to experience the full range and relatively less fat and relatively more fat. The amount of protein should be relatively consistent now, so that the range of protein isn't anywhere near as large. And somewhere between, like, for say just an adult male, somewhere between 70 and maybe at absolute max of 150 grams of protein per day. And then the rest of it would come from carbohydrate. So you can get too much protein. You really almost can't get too much fat, and you can get too much carb. So that's why we have to just keep a little bit more track of the protein and the carb. And then we can have almost like a free-for-all with fat, because fat has much more ability to make you satiated, and you tend to have a really hard time overdoing it, as long as that's not to say that you can't overeat. You can still overeat because you can eat way too much carb and way too much protein. But it's hard to overeat too much fat because you just kind of feel, you know, nauseated, actually. You know, if you have more than maybe 3 or 4 eggs, you kind of just feel like egged out, right? Like, I don't want to see another egg for a couple of days.
However, I don't feel that way with bacon. But being serious, though, you mentioned it before, the quality and the source matters. So for everyone listening who hasn't read Kate's book or doesn't understand, she is not telling you to go out and eat, you know, deep fried stuff at the county fair, because there's certain types of fat that you should be eating and certain types of fat that will make your body a very, very sick
That's
place.
What I was thinking during the whole thing. I said, Doc, I don't want to know where my food comes from.
Big
that
Kirk
I don't
is,
eat high-quality food, but, you know, some of the processing these days and stuff like that, I just, you know.
And that's the tragedy. That's the problem.
He was, He was ready to run out and get a Baconator.
Yeah. Now I've changed my mind. I'm going to right. shake.
Well, you could eat bacon, but it should be bacon from a grass pasture yeah. farm, right, Kate? That's where I get my bacon from now.
I love one of the quotes from Robert Sacre from last year. He said that he now has gone so whole hog, he's all in with this way of eating, that he said, you know, he doesn't want to eat one of those. He must have his grass-fed meat. He doesn't want, he calls them wannabe cows if it's not grass-fed. So he's really embraced this way of eating. And yeah, the truth is not, you know, you don't want to know where some of the stuff that we are presented with as, and you know, it says this is food, right? You don't want to know what happened to it or how it got there. And that's just a reality. But when you can, it's good to try and go to that next level of, you know, maybe getting the pastured or the organic or whatever's in your budget or whatever you like the taste of, just to start exploring that whole realm of higher quality animal products, because that is the only way that we're ever going to see major change where that sort of stuff is available. It's, you know, we live in a consumer driven society, and the more people go after that stuff, the more we're going to see these CAFOs, these industrial farms being less successful, you know, and more family farms hopefully coming back to flourish again, give us the kind of meats that our ancestors got that we want.
Cool. Ken, you know, I'm a huge UConn fan, so when your story came out, I was really intrigued to see what Ray Allen said about how switching his diet extended his career. He says he's been able to get a few more years out, and he feels he can play for a few more years. I want to ask, you know, you've been around the game. When did this change? When did these players, like the seismic shift happen where, you know, they realize maybe they need to start eating better?
Well, it's a great question, and it hasn't happened across the board for all of them yet. But, you know, I've been around the NBA on and off since roughly, 1996. And through the years, you know, I can remember walking into a locker room before a game and seeing the guys eating nothing but pizzas and chicken tenders and cheeseburgers and junk food. And you still see some of that, but somewhere along the way, I would guess it's been in the last 5 years, you've started to hear about players adopting a healthier diet, or at least what they perceive to be a healthier diet. And I think it really hasn't been until Kate did what she did with the Lakers, it hasn't been formalized. Now other teams are starting to catch on. You know, if you walk into the Clippers locker room after a game, they'll have, you know, ground turkey and gluten-free pasta as one of the options. They'll have ribs. They'll have vegetables. They'll have kale chips and a lot of the things that the Lakers are doing. So it really has been a shift. You know, there are still going to be your holdouts, and it's probably, unfortunately, still the majority who, as we, you know, touched on earlier, just believe that their bodies can out-train and outwork what they put in them. And yeah, that can work in the short term, like Kate said, on the micro picture. It can work for this guy, you know, eating McDonald's for 6 months. But it's not going to be a long-term solution. And, you know, if you're a 23-year-old professional athlete, maybe you can get by. But eventually, if you're good enough and if you're able to prolong your career, you're going to be a 33-year-old or a 38-year-old professional athlete. And at that point, you're going to have nothing to fall back on. You're going to have no baseline, no foundation for health. So I think that's been a really important change, and it needs to happen even more.
And Ken, to your point, the best athlete, Kobe, attributes his energy to diet completely. And Kate has that on her blog, right, Kate?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the funny thing is that athletes are very superstitious. And so on one level, I can kind of empathize with them saying, you know, like, and Kobe himself said that when he did his 81-point game, that was on, I think he said Domino's Pizza and Pepsi or something like that.
Oh,
and, you know, so
yeah.
So on one level, they, they know that it's, it matters what you eat. But on another level, there's like this superstition, like, well, if I did that well with, you know, that eating that, maybe I need to keep eating that, because just like I need to wear my, you know, fancy red shoes or chew the right flavor chewing gum or these other superstitions that develop surrounding gameplay. I believe there's a little bit of superstition surrounding that. I'd be curious if your impression of some of the, like the improved diets that you saw were more consistent, like with the paleo. And I'll tell you why I'm wondering it. Because one of the things that I love about this paleo movement is that they make dieting, the paleo movement is making dieting, which is essentially, you know, used to be in the realm of, you know, girls wanting to look better in a bikini, sort of a feminine thing. They make it tough, right? Because now you're eating the way a caveman eats, and, you know, cavemen, well, that's like the quintessential athlete, right? they don't worry about what they look like in a bikini. They're just strong enough to fight gorillas and eat rocks. Or that's true. Maybe.
Well,
a little,
I think I've seen less the guys who are conscious of it. I've seen them and the players that I talked to for the series of articles I did. They're very into making sure your plate has a lot of different colors on it. You know, making sure there are a wide array of vegetables. They do eat fruit. Sometimes for those of us who are not as active as a professional athlete, you know, fruit can be a little problematic. It is fructose, which is sugar. So, but if you're as active as they are, they seem to do fine with it. And I think, you know, with Ray Allen, he started out on a strict paleo diet because he found that he was, you know, he's in his late 30s now, he's getting toward the end of his career. He found himself being reliant on anti-inflammatory medicine just to get ready to play and just to get through a game. And he found that taking out the inflammatory foods really helped him feel better, helped his knees feel better, helped his joints feel better. But he did find something that I've also come around to in my experimentation with nutrition, is that he felt like he was missing something, and he really felt like he needed more carbohydrates. And I would ask Kate, like, it's not just, I know we can get carried away with the percentages of fat versus protein versus carbohydrates, but for people who are active, whether you're a professional athlete or you're just a weekend warrior, or you're in the gym working out 3 or 4 or 5 days a week, are carbohydrates, and I mean those that not the ones that come from vegetables and fruit, but maybe that come from potatoes and other sources, are they okay for active people? How
Absolutely.
Much is okay, and is the timing important? Because I found that if you eat them right after you work out, I find that works better for me.
Well, before you answer, I want it, because Ken touched on the point that I wanted to get to next, and I just want to let everyone know, in conjunction with plugging your blog or your website, because they should go over there. But it's a great question, Ken. And Kate has this awesome post on her website, which is drkate.com. And the title of it is called "When Martians Attack, Carbo Loading Could Spell Your Doom!" Exclamation point. And I thought it was, first of all, it's hilarious. It's really, really well said. I wrote to her. I was like, you're brilliant. It's my favorite post on her website. But her analogy basically serves to show us that you actually don't need many carbs if you're a fat adapted person, which we could talk about later, unless you're an elite athlete and or have really low body fat. Like Kate was working with me and my good friend Jason Van Oyen, who's a undefeated fighter, and I don't need any carbs, but he was like, I'm dying, and she told him to have a cannoli, and I was like, this is completely unfair. So he texted me that he just had this cannoli after his second workout, and I was like, you know what, don't even talk to me, dude. Like,
I would teach you too, Aaron. I'm like, oh, enjoying this cannoli.
Yeah, thanks, Herc.
So there was a lot of topics we could we touched on here, but the basic thing is that human beings are designed to preferentially burn fat for endurance activities. So walking, jogging, biking, we are designed to burn fat. And what I mean by that is if we burn sugar, which is a less optimal fuel, we produce too much acid, and it affects how our mitochondria work. It affects our muscle strength. It impairs it actually by as much as 30%. So you want to be a fat burner for these endurance type activities, but if you don't have the right macronutrients in your diet for a certain amount of time, and depending on your genetics, you can actually lose that ability to burn fat easily. Not just with exercise, but during the day. And so that you can become incredibly distracted by hunger every 4 hours, and it changes your moods, and it makes it very easy to gain weight. It makes you very susceptible to eating the wrong kinds of foods. So being fat adapted, as you mentioned, Erin, is essential to normal health. And then the next level of the discussion is, well, what do extreme athletes do? You know, what like an extremely elite kind of level NBA athlete or a soccer player or anybody who's a professional athlete? Well, they will be so active that at times they use a good amount of sugar because of the intensity of the exercises going to outstrip the ability of oxygen to be delivered to the muscle. So, in other words, if you're pumping your muscle really hard, you get that burn feeling because after a while, you're just not getting enough oxygen in there and your muscle's still going to operate. You're not going to die. That would be terrible if we couldn't operate without oxygen, if we didn't have an alternative fuel for those times when we really needed to run away from a lion or run after deer. Yeah, especially the Martians. So that's where the sugar comes in. But it's really only for that kind of intense anaerobic activity that we need to be sugar burners. And the tragedy of athletic nutrition and the legacy of, so-called research in athletic nutrition is that they completely ignore the fact that we need fat and that fat is a primary fuel for most activities. And they have dived into this idea that sugar is the primary fuel. And when you do that, when you fuel your athletic performance ahead of time by loading up with sugar, you block your body's ability to burn fat and you alter your metabolism in a profound way that impairs your performance. And so that even though you have these athletes who are doing incredible things, they would, I have to believe, be even more incredible had they been getting the right fuel for their athletic performance. But that's not to say that they never eat carbs, right? Once you do all that intense activity, you drain the carbohydrate stores in your muscle. Those are called glycogen stores, and you need to refill those, that's all. So after you exercise, that's the best time to have your carbohydrates. So you work up your appetite.
With the
cannoli. Yes, exactly.
Ken, just to follow up from an earlier thing you said, you know, about the these locker rooms have healthier alternatives after games or whatever like that. Is this the athletes demanding it, or is it more that, you know, would you say the team saying, we invested so many millions in these players, you know, we need to do a better job of making sure they're on the court?
That would be the smart one.
You know, it's interesting. I think that for the most part, it comes from the players. You know, teams provide, you know, have long provided food on the road. They cater the meals on the team charters, and they provide the buffet post game and in the hotel on the practice day and whatnot. But they're, until very recently, there hasn't been, to my knowledge, a whole lot of coordination and a whole lot of thought behind it. It was just, well, they need, it was the old carbo loading, you know, idea that we touched on, you know, well, they need a lot of spaghetti and they need, you know, they need to load up on all that good stuff.
Rice and chicken, boneless, skinless chicken breast. That was the typical approach. And that's actually what, you know, having Gary Vee has this, you know, 28, 30 year perspective. And he says that over the time that he's been with the Lakers, there have been periods where they do try to get better nutrition in an organized way, but that tends to fall apart because the standard line of nutrition, sports nutrition thought is just plain old not delicious. You know, how much brown rice and whole grains and boneless, skinless stuff and broccoli with no butter on it, no salt can you know, an athlete really put up with, right?
If only they knew they could have bacon and butter.
Yeah, exactly. So what we're doing with the Lakers is, I believe, unique in that we are embracing the latest in nutrition science and doing that on a team level, so that we are giving it to them, even if they don't even know it, they're getting the better quality food. And Gary, though, has always told us that it does need to come from the athletes in terms of making the choices. So there's some things we can kind of slip in there and they won't even notice. Like, we use the better quality oils. We have more of the sort of meat on the bone kind of options and the boneless, skinless type of stuff. I mean, who misses that? I don't think anybody on the team has complained about not having that. So we want it to kind of be a little bit below the radar, you know, at least for some of the stuff. And then for the guys who want to go all in and go whole hog, the kind of guys that would be, if there were no program, doing it on their own and perhaps even trying to get the rest of the team to do it, we want to provide the kind of options for those guys as well, so that they can be as whole hog and all in as they want to be and as they would, you know, be doing on their own. Just make it easier for them.
I don't want to get too nerdy here.
Yes, you do, Ken.
But Erin's already made it nerdy enough with all her fancy words. So I want to ask
homocysteine and glycine.
So I want to ask Dr. Kate, what is the difference between an athlete being fat adapted and an athlete being in ketosis, and who wants to be in ketosis and for how long? And I'll let her explain what that is.
Yeah, what is ketosis? Is it's very popular these days. So a lot of people who may not know what it is have maybe heard it, and it refers to a very special state of fat adaptation where the body is so used to burning fat, so prefers fat, so able to dip into fat stores and use them as fuel, that you almost never get hungry. And you produce this byproduct of the muscles, when they burn fat and in excess, they actually leak these little molecules called ketones. And ketones can be used by the brain and some other tissues as fuel in ways that fatty acids may not be able to. So that you have this incredible level energy, particularly brain function. You know, your concentration is maxed out. You just don't feel hungry because you always have this energy supply, because we have 40,000 calories. The average NBA player has about 40,000 calories in reserve of fat, which is enough to run all the way from San Francisco to LA.
I don't recommend that, by the way.
Yes, just a disclaimer, we're not suggesting that you run that far. Our last guest.
So to answer your question as briefly as possible, it's in like an extreme state of fat adaptation. But the interesting thing about what we call fat adaptation is that some people say that athletes are all fat adapted. And the reason they say that is because muscles will very easily burn fat. And that's true. Athletes probably couldn't perform at the level that they do unless their muscles would very easily burn fat. But that's not the same as being fat adapted. So I would have to argue that athletes are not all truly fat adapted, because a lot of them will get hungry when they're not exercising. So that even though they are able to burn, their muscles are very good at burning fat while they're exercising, when they stop, they're not able to, the fat stores under the skin are not able to release the fatty acids. And so they'll still feel hungry. So by my definition, and because these are like terms that are sort of in flux and everybody has a different understanding of them, my understanding is that you're fat adapted if you can tap into your fat stores seamlessly without really feeling hungry. And ketosis is such an extreme form of that you never go through what cyclists call bonking, where you run out of your glycogen after about 800 calories of aerobic exercise. You run out of your glycogen stores, and then your brain, which if you're not keto adapted, depends on sugar, your brain has nothing to go on, and you completely flatline in your performance and you feel like death, basically. If you're keto adapted, you don't feel that way, and you can just sort of blast through so much more performance without feeling any kind of drain on your brain.
And I think that's a great place to wrap this up, Kate. Obviously, we could talk about 10,000 other things. I have like 50 pages of notes, and we'll have to have you back on another time. But
I'd love to come back.
Just to sort of cap off that fat adaption, that was a great question by Ken, because I know he and I have actually discussed it and what I think of being in ketosis and all that sort of stuff. Mm. But I can just say from personal experience, and this is not a paid endorsement of Dr. Kate Shanahan whatsoever. She's not paying me anything. But
that's
honestly,
a lie. I can see the money in your pocket right now.
This is all my fat energy.
I was going to say my body's fat adaption, so you know.
No, but in all seriousness, and following these principles, literally just, and we have another person sitting in the room who did another similar sort of diet that I did prior to embarking on this journey I'm doing with Kate, and he can attest to this. But adopting those principles and truly experiencing your body shifting to being, quote, fat adapted. I emailed Kate and her husband, Luke, because he helped write the book. And I'm like, guys, I have so much energy. I don't know what to do with myself. Like, I literally couldn't tire myself out.
You were bouncing off the walls.
It was crazy. Literally bouncing off the walls.
There you go.
No, but I mean, in my workouts and just everything, it was the most remarkable thing, I swear, the most remarkable thing I ever experienced. And the eating of the food was actually enjoyable because you're not depriving yourself. Like, I literally don't crave carbohydrates. I haven't eaten any grains or sugar in, I don't know, months, and I don't miss it. It's crazy.
Jeez.
So it's really, really, really works. And when I tried to do the quote paleo method before understanding all of this stuff,
yeah,
I completely failed miserably. I thought it was horrible. I was very anti-paleo because I felt so bad when I did it. And then doing it this way, it's just amazing to see the whole body change. Like, pain I had is gone. My eyes are whiter. I sleep better. I'm telling you, my clothes fit better. It's crazy. So it really, really does work. There's definitely a method to the scientific madness. Kate, before we go, I just want to let you, we'll plug your website. Obviously, it's drkate.com. I encourage everyone to check it out. She also has two books, on Amazon, which you can also check out. Deep Nutrition is fantastic. And
thank you, Erin.
Yeah, it's
DRCATE, but by the way, for the doctor, you don't spell out the word doctor.
Yes, that's
thank
that's
you.
Good. Thank you, doctor. That's a good catch. And if you really quickly want to tell everybody out there what new stuff you've got coming down the pipeline, I know you're doing something with Mark Sisson, who's the best-selling author of The Primal Blueprint. He's been on Dr. Oz and the Oprah Network and all that stuff. Anything you want to share with the listeners?
We're going to be launching a program called The Primal Advantage, where people can consult with me one-on-one from anywhere around the world that they can get in touch with me. And we will be measuring 6 aspects of metabolic function and optimizing any weak areas. And it's all going to be with totally natural methods. There's going to be no prescriptions and some pretty essential but fairly basic and inexpensive lab tests. So you can check it out on my website, drkate.com, drcate.com, or Mark Sisson's Mark's Daily Apple under his services tab.
Perfect. And people can also follow you on Twitter. Tell us what your Twitter handle is, please.
It's kate.shanahan1.
Oh, no, that's your Skype name.
I think it's the same.
I think your Twitter is at Dr. Kate Shanahan.
You're telling our guests what her Twitter
account
is?
No, I'm serious. I'm looking at it now.
That's sources confirm that.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
It's at DR Kate Shanahan, at DR Kate Shanahan.
I am socially inept both in real time and on the web.
Not at all. I just want to make sure people can find you. And of course, Ken Berger, thank you so much for joining us as well. And tell everybody where they can follow you.
It was a pleasure. And I'm on Twitter at KBergCBS, KBERGCBS. And, of course, all my work's at CBSSports.com on the NBA. And I hope to be back here with Erin because I really enjoy talking about this stuff as well. So it's been an educational experience for me and glad I was able to be a part of it.
Thank you. And, you know, Ken, the next time you're on, it'll get even nerdier because we're going to talk CrossFit and argue. And
sweet.
We will nerd out and Herc will leave the room to go catch his deer.
No, I will be the judge. All right. I'll say who wins. So, you know, grease the wheels now if you want to be the victor.
Oh, wait, that's right. Before I let you guys go, though, Dr. Kate, actually, two things. One, you have to address really quickly Big Herc's bowl and a hat or whatever.
Taco and a helmet.
His taco and a helmet. And please tell him why the taco and the helmet is nutritionally unsound.
Well, What we could do with your, if you must have a taco in a helmet, you could just simply go and order a taco salad and take the contents of that and turn them upside down into your helmet. And then just don't eat the helmet if you can remember.
Or the corn chips.
Oh, you know, no wonder. I thought the meal tastes a little plastic, so.
You don't want that BPA. And Kate, also, before I don't know how I forgot this. Before you go, I always ask our guests to reach into their sort of tool bag and give our listeners three tips. So three tips for living like an athlete, in this case, eating like an athlete, whether that's recommendations for things they can go out and buy or anything that's free that they can do, just like your top three things.
So for exercise, a lot of people ask, what's the best exercise? I say the best is any exercise that you enjoy doing, because you're gonna do it. In terms of nutrient timing, just work up your appetite. Don't worry about fueling before exercise, because you got plenty of fuel under your skin. And number three is make sure to rest. Don't overdo it, because that is such a recipe for autoimmune disorders and other, even cancer.
All right. Sound advice from the doctor. Thank you very much to both Dr. Kate Shanahan and Ken Berger. Really enjoyed chatting with you. And Herc, I don't know. I'll bring a helmet for you next time.
She's like, I don't know what I do with her.
You know? That's not true at all.
I'm out. See ya.
No, you bring levity to the program.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it. Remember, everybody, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can email us at likeanathlete@cbsi.com with suggestions for future shows, questions, anything you heard on this show you want to know more about. Please feel free. You can also tweet at us. I'm at Aaron Schroney. Big Herc is actually at CBS Herc, H-U-R-C, not Big Herc. That's what you should call him. And we'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Herc.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Ciao.